Hello and welcome to My Camino, the podcast. I'm Dan Mullins and it's great to have your company. Christmas is out of the way, a new year beckons. So happy new year to all my listeners and contributors. 2019. Soon it will be 2020. It's extraordinary when you think about it. And there are many journeys ahead. The US poet and philosopher Henry David Thoreau said, "Methinks that the moment my legs begin to move, my thoughts begin to flow. The Camino is calling." My guest this week is an Australian author and pilgrim, Noel Braun. And I had heard of Noel's work via my Camino contacts, but it was a chance meeting with some of friends of Noel's last week that prompted me to reach out. He's on the line from the Snowy Mountains. Noel Braun, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me on. Yeah.
You have an amazing story to tell, and we'll get to it in a moment. But first, right. Do you remember how you first heard about the Camino de Santiago?
Yes. It was the first time I actually heard of it was back in the 90s when, at that time, I was living in Sydney up near Terry Hills, and we went to church there regularly, and one of the other parishioners walked it, the Camino, with his daughter, and he wrote a little article about it in our parish magazine, and I thought, that's a good idea, although at that time I had no thought that I would ever do it. Back then, it wasn't until probably 2006 that I actually decided, yes, I shall walk the Camino one of these days, and then it wasn't until 2010 that I actually took the first steps from Le Puy-en-Velay in France. There.
Would you consider yourself a spiritual person?
Yes, I do. Yes, because I certainly see the Camino very much as a spiritual journey. Like any pilgrimage, so the Camino is a metaphor for the journey of the spirit. And so that all of the ups and downs, the joys and tribulations that you experience on the Camino, they are a replication of the spiritual life of what happens to you on your inner journey.
Yeah, how beautifully put. Yeah. That's really beautifully put. Yeah. I want to take a step back. You were a country school teacher. Tell us about life in rural Australia in those days, because you ended up in the corporate world and in the big smoke. Do you look back fondly on your time as a country school teacher?
Well, yes, I do. I think it was at about the age of 20. I went to a tiny little school in the Victorian Mallee, a little one-teacher school with about a dozen children. And it was a place called Coolanong, about 50 miles up the road from Swan Hill. Deep in that 10 miles in off the Murray, it was deep Mallee country. It was my introduction to sort of rural life because I'd been brought up in Melbourne. And it was, in a way, I did become very fond of the rural and country life because I found the people there. They, even though they lived in remote areas, their outlook was broad. They lived it tough, and life for them was very capricious. You know, they depended very much upon the seasons. They all had big holdings, 3,000 or 4,000 acres. And they grew wheat and reared sheep. And what was really nice about it was their social social life, the social activities of that little town evolved around the football club. And I even managed to get a game with the football club and became the secretary. So, in addition to that, of course, I had my job as the teacher. And in a little place like that, you know, it's like a family.
Yeah.
In fact, we were a family, and I used to be quite thrilled when every now and then the kids would forget and call me Dad.
Oh, wow. How gorgeous. Yeah, you know. How lovely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So I had the 2 years in the Mallee, and then I had the 2 years in Gippsland in a little school called Neerham North, a completely different style country. It was all dairy farming, and the people were really quite different too, different outlook.
Yeah.
Different approach to life there. And also I didn't get so involved in the community because it being near Melbourne, I was coming back and forth most weekends. I look back now on those 4 years I had of teaching, and as a joke, I say to people, that 4 years of teaching in a little one teacher school ruined me for life, because I made every decision I had to make, you know, from what to teach the kids to, you know, when to sweep the floor and all that sort of stuff. And I developed a great deal of self-reliance, and I was never comfortable with a boss.
Yeah.
After that,
never
cut it. It was okay if the boss decided to do the way I thought it should be done. But when he wanted to do it differently, yeah, that's where I felt decidedly uncomfortable.
So, life in a country town and life as a teacher in a one teacher school set you up for a life in the corporate world. Where did this passion for writing come about?
I was always interested in writing. I used to write poetry as an adolescent. In fact, I won a prize once, would you believe? But I didn't do very much. But what happened while I was in the corporate life, I started to write various articles for management magazines. I was in a human resource management consulting company, and my employers didn't mind me spending company time writing these articles, as long as I put down at the end of the article my name and where I work.
Yeah,
so it was a bit of PR for. A bit of PR for them. And then I thought I would like to write a novel one of these days. Like these phrases, one of these days we use.
Yeah,
Then I thought, now what should I write about? And I thought I could write a story about my experience of life in a remote rural locality in a one-teacher school, because I had a very clear memory of everything that happened. And as it turned out, I used to write a letter every week to my mother, and my mother kept them all.
Oh.
So I had a perfect record of what happened in those days. So it was back in the 70s, yes, in the mid-70s, that I wrote the first drafts of my first novel. In those days, it was all handwritten, and I used to take it round with me, and wherever. I did a lot of travelling those in those days. I'd take it with me, and instead of spending, you know, an evening in a hotel down in the bar, I would sit up there and write my manuscript. Mind you, I'd still visit the bar, but I wouldn't spend all night there. And my sister Maria used to type it for me. Anyway, I put it aside. I put it aside there for, must have been nearly 30 years. And I saying to myself, again, one of these days I'll get back to that. So it wasn't till somewhere around about 2000 that I took it up again, and of course had to rewrite it all extensively. So then my first novel came out in 2004, it was a story. It was a story, a coming of age story. It was a clash of cultures. It was a struggle of a little community trying to keep its school open, because once the school closed, the community's half dead. So, and it went very well. It's very well. It's now in its third print.
Friend and philosopher.
That's right. Friend and philosopher. Because that's based on the idea that the Teachers College lecturers used to tell the students that country school teachers should be the friend and philosopher of the district. So my hero, who's a bit of an idealist, really took that up and tried to apply it. However, he didn't have quite the maturity to pull it off, and that's the interesting part of the story of that, how it eventually manages to make it through.
And then there's a second book, Whistler Street.
Whistler Street was Whistler Street's a different story altogether. It's a story of two guys who grew up together on the surf beaches of Western Australia. And then the action moves to Sydney, to Manly, to Whistler Street, and there is a Whistler Street in Manly. And the action goes back and forth. It was originally going to be four short stories. That's how I started, on the theme of unrequited love. But I managed to put them all into the one. Technically, I think that Whistler Street is a better novel than Friend and Philosopher. But on the other hand, the reader is the boss, and the readers like Friend and Philosopher. So, and then I had written about 40,000 words of another novel, because that's where I saw I was going. But then an event then occurred that completely changed the whole course of my life.
That's right. The next book is a memoir, No Way to Behave at a Funeral. And it was dealing with the death by suicide of your wife.
Yes.
Walk us through that journey.
Okay, my wife Maris, she suffered from depression, and as the years as the years advanced, it grew. You know, the depression took a stronger grip of her. Initially, it was one or two weeks a year that she went into the depths. But then she managed to revive herself and live a normal sort of life for most of the year. And as the years advanced, that the influence of the Depression spread. So that in the last year or two, it was a constant companion. And there was a history of mental illness in the family, in that both her sisters had died by suicide. She said she would never take her own life, but I think the pain was that intense that it was, it's something that she couldn't cope with any longer. And to the, you know, to the people, she hit it very well, except only the family and her close friends were aware of the suffering that she was experiencing. And it was a great surprise to many when she took her own life. And in fact, now I look at the clock and it's about 10:30 on a Saturday morning, and which was about the time that the police arrived. As you'd be aware, she died on a Saturday. So I usually resolve each Saturday not to think about it too much. But anyway, what happened is that her death completely upset every assumption and value that I had in life. You know, I'd lost my sense of identity from being one of a couple to being one on my own. And I can recall making conscious decisions at the time that this was not going to beat me. And I was I resolved to, you know, sort of keep pressing on and try and get some value out of the experience. I was already involved with Lifeline as a telephone counsellor, and then I became involved with supporting other people who had been bereaved by suicide. In fact, I was involved in facilitating groups of very courageous people, you know, who were facing a journey similar to myself. And I was with them. I had two hats on. I was a trained professional for a start, because my training is in psychology, but I was also talking from experience. So I knew what was authentic, what was real, you know, what was genuine.
Yeah, that's right.
I didn't doubt it anyway. As far as the writing was concerned, I put aside the novel. It's still there, waiting one of these days. As I said, I'll get back to it. But I put it aside and I decided I'm going to write this account, this memoir of my own grief journey. It was therapeutic for me, and it would also be helpful to others on the same journey. I couldn't touch it for 12 months or more, because the pain of recall would have been too intense. But as the pain became less intense, it was still fairly painful writing it, recalling all the detail. I did write it, and I think every word of that was written straight from the heart. So when that came out, it's got a limited market. I was aware of that, but I've had some extraordinary feedback on that, and still have, and people are still buying it, and I'm still getting emails from people who've said they've just read it and had to contact me. So I feel honoured, you know, that I have managed to create something which has been of value and helpful to sort of many people.
I was just about to say, you talk about it, you go out and talk to people about it at sort of at festivals and in libraries and things.
Yes.
And that must take an enormous bravery. But just before we go on to the next question, I just want to ask you, because if somebody is listening, they might be interested in how depression manifests itself in daily life. You say that your wife years ago would sort of spiral into the depths for a few weeks a year. And the reason I'm asking that question also, Noel, is because if somebody, and you say it's very difficult for people to identify that somebody is depressed, perhaps somebody's listening thinking, how can I tell if somebody's depressed? What are the symptoms? How does it manifest itself in daily life?
All right. Well, it's often a listlessness, a lack of motivation, fearfulness, anxiety, a constant apprehension. These are some of the things I think. A general feeling of just unable to get on with things. And then when people used to say, not so much now, give yourself a good shake and get out of it, the person who's suffering it would usually say, if only I could. The signs are, I suppose, it's the signs of thinking about suicide are the ones that sort of one should look out for. And then sometimes the depression sufferer issues what they call invitations. And there are comments like, I'm not much good. People won't miss me when I'm not here. That sort of stuff. The real giveaway is when they might be actually giving away what they regard as precious things for themselves. You know, I mightn't need this anymore. The thing for the person, if somebody feels that they know somebody who's suffering depression, is it encouraging to go and seek help? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
First step, go and see your GP, and from there, the GP might be able to help with medication, or they might be able to refer to specialist help.
Yeah, that's why I asked the question.
Yeah,
because if we can help one person, then that's a step in the right direction.
Very much so, very much so. And I tend to see myself as a bit of an advocate for suicide awareness and prevention.
Yeah.
And that's why I was involved with Lifeline. Less so now that I live here in the Snowy Mountains, but there's still an opportunity in our local community to be alert to people who are on their own and are doing it tough. In fact, there are two or three of us had a little discussion just before Christmas, and we decided to put on Facebook a little message. Think about those people whom you know that are lonely at this time. You know, this is events like Christmas. There's often a peak in suicide or suicide attempts. So just be alert to those that you may know, and if you can, reach out to them. That was a little message we just gave to put on our Facebook, our notice board, Dinderby notice board. So hopefully some people noted that and took action on it.
Is someone left behind by suicide, someone like yourself, a survivor?
Yeah. Yes. Initially, the person who's bereaved by suicide is regarded as at risk themselves, and some do succumb, but generally people survive it and manage to overcome it, and although they will never get used to it, they learn to cope with it and live with it. It becomes part of one's life. And you get on with things.
Yeah.
You get on with things. There's a small percentage of people who don't, who can't. But I think most people seem to have the resilience.
You say the grief banishes... Yeah, you say the grief banishes survivors to a place so removed from the normal hurly-burly of everyday life that they feel close to madness. Somehow, they have to claw their way back. So how did you claw your way back?
Okay. What I did initially is it was at the same time as my... wife died, that friend and philosopher came out. So the end of 2004 was both very, very bad news and also a bit of good news. So what I did over that next year is I got out and flogged that book. I got out. That was my purpose.
Yeah.
I found a purpose. I got out and flogged it. My children... chastise me for using the word flog, but that's pretty well what I did. I did go overseas briefly in the beginning of 2005, but that was a disaster because it was far, far too early. But at least I spent a little time, involved in planning it. And that when I came back, the grief was just waiting there. But I did go overseas again in 2006, and I spent nearly 6 months in France. And I went to live in a little town called Chambéry in the French Alps, and I enrolled in a French language school. And it was there that I would go to the cathedral each Sunday. And it was there that I would see groups of pilgrims with their backpacks and their shells being blessed. And they were off to Santiago. And that's when, the idea of the Camino came back into my mind. And that's when I said, yeah, that's a good idea. I'll do that one of these days. But it took me 4 years. It wasn't until 2010 that I did the first steps of my first Camino, as I mentioned before.
Yeah, and the clawing back begins.
Yeah, and I saw the planning and the preparation of that for the Camino, an opportunity to... give my life a bit of structure, and also in terms of the spiritual preparation, what was I doing it for, what questions I was seeking answers for, trying to define the actual questions in the first place. So it was not only just the physical preparation, preparing my body, but it was also preparing the spirit for the arduous aspects of pilgrimage. Pilgrimage is not like a stroll in the park. It's definitely taking a step out of your comfort zone and into the unknown. You can do so much planning. But there's always unpredictable, and you have to be prepared to accept that if anything's likely to go wrong, it will. And then it's how you cope with these adversities, which is part of your journey. It's part of that journey that strengthens you, you know, and gives you further courage and self-reliance to continue.
Yeah,
in much the same way as you do so in life. That's why I see there's such a close parallel between life on the Camino as a pilgrimage and life as a pilgrim in your day-to-day life. Yeah.
That's a beautiful line. You know, so a lot of people say that your Camino begins the day you decide to go.
And yeah, I would accept that.
Yeah, and therefore, and this, and you've just summed up in the last couple of minutes perfectly what my next suggestion to you is, that the Camino is a great healer. Because if your Camino begins the day you decide to go, you've begun healing.
Yes, I would certainly accept that. And I used to receive great joy from some of the people whom I'd met on the Camino, fellow pilgrims, who were prepared to tell their story. Sometimes it took a couple of red wines, you know, for people to open up. And I always thought the wonderful way to develop trust is to share a meal together. So, you know, if you could share a meal with other pilgrims, in no time people were prepared to open up. Because in general, our normal day-to-day life is a bit of mistrust and suspicion. And, you know, people revealing their vulnerabilities, but it seems to be far more acceptable to do so on the Camino, to share your vulnerabilities. And I've heard some wonderful stories from people as they begin to talk about what has triggered off their interest in the Camino and has created the desire to pursue it. Yeah.
People talk about the energy of the Camino. How do you describe it to people? If you're at home, but you're back in Australia, and someone says, "Oh, I've heard about this Camino," how do you describe the energy to them?
Well, I think we usually talk about it in terms of the Camino. The Camino has a mystical life of itself, takes on a life of its own. Even though you may initially have gone on the Camino for some specific reason, some healing process, the Camino then seems to become an entity itself that motivates you and attracts you, and then more importantly, as soon as you get home, it draws you back, and you want to continue the journey in that way. And of course, what happens when you get home, you forget all the difficulties and discomforts and hardships. You remember, of course, all the highlights and some of those joys of people all you meet. Yeah. But that doesn't matter. It's that life that it takes on. And then people talk in terms of the Camino looks after you. Other people, more religious, say God will look after you on the Camino, don't worry. People will say the Camino looks after you, don't worry. As far as I'm concerned, they're the same thing. There's a sort of this great depth, great spiritual depth, I think, to the Camino. When you think of it, people have been walking it for over 1,000 years. And I often think everyone who's walked the Camino leaves just a tiny bit of their own essence there. So just think of that wonderful collective spirit that lies there. Because when you walk the Camino, you're walking the same path as so many other people. You look down and you see the footprints of the people who have walked that day or the day before. And if you want to go down through a few layers, there's the footprints that have been walking, you know, all the way back. You leave your footprints. And in turn, people coming after you will leave their footprints. So there's this great collective, a collective that spreads not only with the people that you're walking now, but the people who have walked in the past and in the future. And that's a marvellous bond to think about. And also, as you're walking, you're part of creation. There's some delightful country that you sort of walk through, particularly in France, and you feel so tied to it, so much part of it. And if you drive by in a car or in a coach, you're remote from it. You're in a capsule. But if you're walking through it, you've got time to stop and look. Look around. And I'm currently in a mode, riding mood at the moment. And I've just described this day that I sat in the ditch by the side of the road to eat my lunch at 8 watching a beetle struggling up the embankment and kept on falling back. You know, the little grass was too light and would fall back, but up it would get and kept going. And I thought, now that's an allegory for our own pilgrimage, for our own sort of journey. And when I try to talk, sometimes people don't sort of quite, you know, they sort of look at me when I try to talk about things like this. But for me, they're very real as to what the Camino is about.
In your first Camino book, The Day Was Made for Walking, you discovered it was not just the rigorous physical demands, but you said the territory of the heart and soul has its own challenges, which found you searching for spiritual and emotional insights. I'd suggest to you that if you're getting those kind of metaphors from little beetles, that you found some of those insights. But what did you learn about yourself, do you think?
Myself? One of the major things I learned is to ask. Don't be completely self-sufficient. Be prepared to accept help. I do say from a career in the helping professions, I've been reaching out to others, but you know, there are times when you have to accept the help that people offer to you when you reach. When they reach out to you, I'm a churchgoer. I have looked at many of the doctrines that my church holds, and some of them I regard as vital, as important. And others I regard as peripheral and not at all important and not worth worrying about. One of the great things I appreciate about my church is its teaching on social justice and on the value of the individual. Can you reflect, ruminate on these things as to what makes them so vital and so important? So I think I've reached a situation, largely through the Camino, of re-evaluating all of this, of not accepting everything as a neat package, as it were. Sort of dissected it and pulled out of it what I believe is of value, particularly of value to me.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely it does. It's a fantastic answer. I could listen to you all day, to be honest.
Oh, thank you.
I think that somebody like you, you have been through a lot. And you were brave enough in many respects to say to yourself, no, this is not going to define me. And I'm going to claw back, and then to take it a step further again and offer insight into what you have been through is a very I often say here on the podcast that pilgrims are sharers and carers, and that's it's a very pilgrim-like thing to do. But of course the pilgrimage came after what you had been through, and in it you say the book is a journal of the many characters you met, and you said in time you realized you were one of the Camino characters. So tell us about Noel the Pilgrim.
Right. Well, as one of the characters, once again, I'm thinking about my walk last year. I walked from Vesalay. That was my fifth journey last year. But I worked up near Paris and walked south towards the Pyrenees. And I stayed in one refuge earlier on where the lady who looked after us took to me gratefully. You know, here I was, the 84-year-old Australian walking on his own. And after that I met pilgrims. And they said, oh, yes, we know about you. we stayed at so-and-so, and the lady told me then. And then I was just thinking of one place. I rang one refuge to, you know, make a booking there, and I said, oh, we've been waiting for you. This is all in French, mind you. We've been waiting for you. We'd expect you to call or just turn up. So I thought, oh, yes, well, I was sort of one of the characters walking on my own, Australian. And so much so that I ran into a French TV crew. They were from France 3, France 3, and they had their regional and national programs, a bit like Prime Television does here.
Yeah.
And they were making a series of short films about the people who walk through their area and the locals who look after them. So I appeared in this, and I had a drone which followed me for half a day, and I was interviewed. The interview was only about was about 20 minutes, but they only used about 20 seconds in the actual YouTube clip, which I suppose is what generally happens. And I said to the interviewer, I don't know how my French is going to handle this. but he seemed to think I handled it very well. Because, you know, some of these ideas that I've just spoken to you about, sometimes it's difficult enough to express them in English, but when you've got to try and express them in another language, it really tests you.
That's so good.
And I must admit, in terms of being a character, I did reach out to people. I preferred to walk on my own during the day for the silence and the solitude. But in the evening, I did enjoy the company of others, and I would try out what I knew of all the different languages. So I'd say good day in half a dozen languages. Someone I'd meet until I got a response. And if they were, if they knew French or English, fine. But we always managed to communicate, and I've spent evenings with people who didn't know a word of English or French, but we still had a great time together.
Terrific.
Such is the spirit. Such is the spirit of the Camino.
Yeah.
And one of the issues, I think, if you walk the Camino with someone else or with a group, they're the people you tend to talk to and mix with. But if you're on your own, if you want company, well, you've got to step out of yourself and say g'day, or the equivalent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Noel, the second book on the Camino is I'll Guess I'll Just Keep Walking. Is a bit more. Yeah. It's a bit more of a history lesson. Did you enjoy doing the research and learning all those ancient stories?
Oh yes. A lot of that. A lot of the. It's a bit. A lot of it's very much like walking through an outdoor museum.
Yeah.
Because just about every place that you've been to has got a, has got a history. You know, you come across innumerable churches, for example, that were built in the, or they were begun in the, I think, 11th century. Not much of that part of it left. But then in some places, nothing much happened over the years. In other places, lots of things have happened in terms of invading armies and that. And there's one place I visited last year, Bavigny. The only thing I could find in terms of the research was in 1940, with the invading German armies, they put up far more resistance than anywhere else in France. So generally the invasion was a pushover of the Germany into occupied France, but there were some places that resisted it strongly in this Vernigan. That's the only thing I could find in its history. And then, you know, and other places you find nice stories about... once again, in World War II, a site of partisan activity, lots of airdrops from Allied planes, and one particular village that was particularly strong in the resistance. The Germans came in with their panzer attacks and demolished the lot and took everything, except they could not find the village's wine cellar. So that was their great story. Their wine cellar was intact.
That's fantastic.
They did not so well.
That is a great story.
So you hear lovely little stories like that.
And you are a great storyteller, Noel.
And there was one particular one in, it was in Spain. I came across a monument to, I think I mentioned it in, I come across Spain in this, there was this monument in the middle of nowhere, and it, well, Spanish was good enough to read that it was 300 people had been executed here at the beginning of the Spanish Civil War. And actually their bodies were buried just beyond. And they were actually in the process of interring them. That place was really creepy. Now, that place had great meaning and significance for me because I passed lots of other monuments along the way. You know, this is where Charlemagne came through where Napoleon got trounced. But here was an incident that occurred in my lifetime that had far more meaning to me. And it also, the place I'd stayed with, when I looked into research there, the place I'd stayed there in this Villa Franca, the people had been conscripted to bury the bodies and they were traumatised for about 40 or 50 years and wouldn't speak about it. It was only in the last 10 years that people were beginning to start talking about, you know, the trauma of it all. So, yeah. So once you look into the history, you start to get a little feel.
Yeah.
For the life and spirit of the place.
And partly the reason why there is such an extraordinary energy there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
If someone's listening today and thinking of walking the Camino, what would you say to them?
Do it. Yeah, well, do it. Value it for the experience. Value it for the, it's not a pushover. Value it for the experience. Value it for the people that you meet and the stories that they tell you. Be prepared to be listen, be humble, and go for it. I have met some delightful young people who, who for various reasons, I think at that age there, many people in their early 20s still haven't worked out who they are.
Yeah.
And what their sense of identity is. I think that helps to identify who they are and what strengths they might have, which otherwise they may not think they have. And I think it's a valuable experience for everyone, young and old. I'm not the oldest on the Camino. People would seem to be impressed when I tell them, you know, my age in the 80s, walking my 80s. But there have been people in their 90s walking. And, of course, it's not as if you have to do it what I call a hardcore pilgrim's way, that is, carry it all on your back and walk every step. You know, you can. There are many people and companies that will aid you. You know,
yeah.
Many tour companies which will provide you with a bit of an experience.
Yeah, walk your own Camino.
Yeah, that's right. The French have a saying, chacun a son chemin. Each one has his own way.
Yeah. I just wanted to recap for my listeners. Noel's first Camino book was called The Day Was Made for Walking, or is called The Day Was Made for Walking. The second, I guess I'll Just Keep Walking.
On Walking, yeah.
The novels are Friend and Philosopher and Whistler Street. Friends and Philosopher and Whistler Street, and I'm going to give out your website address in a moment, so that people can find your books when they need to. But then there is also the book No Way to Behave at a Funeral, and that is dealing with the suicide of your lovely wife Maris. And just before we go, I wanted to suggest to you that in many ways that book No Way to Behave at a Funeral is a love story.
Oh yes, definitely. And it continues to be a love story there, Dan, because I think of her every day. I have, she's now gone, 14 years, but I think of her every day. I have about 8 or 9 photos of her around the place, and I have the first thing that people do when they walk in my front door is a little shrine there, and I regularly light a candle for her. There, candle has great spiritual significance, spot of light in the darkness. Yeah, it's a love story.
It is indeed.
It's a love story.
I feel terribly privileged to have just shared this hour with you, to be honest. And I asked you earlier if you consider yourself a survivor, and I think you are most definitely a survivor. And you're probably too humble to say it, Noel. So I'll say it, but it's taken a great bravery to survive.
Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah.
And I know you travel a lot these days telling your story. So thank you for taking the time. On behalf of me and my listeners, thank you for your time and your sharing and your caring. And congratulations on your journey. Long may you walk on listening to stories and telling stories.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dan.
And Noel.
And thank you.
Buen camino. Yeah. Buen camino.
Okay. Buen camino. Yeah. Bon chemin.
My guest this week, the Australian author and pilgrim, Noel Braun. And you can find Noel and his books at Noel Braun, B-R-A-U-N, Noel, N-O-E-L, B-R-A-U-N, noelbraun.com.au. The US poet and philosopher Henry David Thoreau said, "Methinks that the moment my legs begin to move, my thoughts begin to flow." Noel Braun has done a lot of thinking, and it's a great gift he's given, plotting the journey of his mind and on foot. Thank you for your company as always. A new year comes to life full of opportunities, stories to tell and journeys to travel. I can hear the Camino calling. Until next week, I'm Dan Mullins. Buen Camino.